Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is July 24th, 2025, and this is episode 537. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Rochester, New York area. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. Today, it's kind of a special episode. John, a.k.a. The Warnerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, is sick. He's going to be okay. He's actually getting better pretty quickly. He's moved to a different dwelling in London. He'll tell you all about it the next time we do an episode, which should be in the next few days. So he's okay. But in the meantime, I have with us friend of the show, previous Radio Warnerd guest, Peter Korotayev of the Great Events in Ukraine newsletter, joining us today to talk about all the noise, the extra noise coming out of Ukraine lately. So first of all, Peter, I know it's early there. Thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, it's good to be here.
The big news, of course, is that for the first time, certainly since the war, since Russia's invasion in February 2022, there has been, large-scale by recent Ukraine standards, or at least, you know, sizable protests against the Zelensky regime. And it has been accompanied by a lot of really bad press at kind of an unusual scale and kind of pitch or tone, really mostly out of the British press, more so than the American press, which is more, I think, kind of internally focused these days with Trump, but really calling for, you know, Zelensky to leave. And these protests against Zelensky, they've been kind of compared to Maidan. I know Peter will argue that it's nothing like that, but I think the two things we need to talk about today are what's caused this protest, what are the protests about, and parallel to that, what's happening in the war, because the war also seems to have reached kind of a new level of pretty bad for Ukraine, that is. So I guess, first of all, Peter, I think maybe we could start this off by recapping, you know, describing what led to this and recapping what NABU and SAPO, these two anti-corruption bureaus, are, what their origins are, and then, you know, how, like, what the significance of them is. Like, how is shutting down some anti-corruption bureau, why does that and not forced mobilization vans and a war going to hell and corruption, but it's that that causes people to come out in the streets?
Yeah. NABU is the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, and then SAPO is the Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office. They're meant to sort of work together. They said don't, but they were set up in 10 years ago, 2015, and they were funded largely by the US and the EU and also, like, Transparency International, Open Society Foundation, so on.
These are Soros-backed organizations, right?
Yeah. And throughout the past 10 years, the different IMF loans were always sort of hinged on, you know, maintaining the independence of the NABU. And what this meant was essentially choosing the right people to head the NABU and to be in the NABU, and often even Poroshenko's pro-Western government also got into sort of conflicts with the NABU and wanted his people in there. To a lesser extent, probably, than under Zelensky. But the West would always say, you can't have this IMF funds unless you put our people in there. And these people would be chosen by the civil society activists, as they call themselves, in Ukraine, the NGO ecosystem that sort of close to the U.S. embassies and met with the U.S. ambassadors on a regular basis and said who they want to be in charge. Coincidentally as well, one of the funny things about NABU is that really there's a huge amount of corruption scandals involving the NABU heads themselves. that were chosen. I mean, one of the most famous ones is Artyom Sitnik, who was the head of NABU for a long time, and he's been involved in sort of countless. He was a prosecutor in Crimea as well, a long time ago, obviously, and he's just a, just essentially a sort of a judge that became friends with the activists, but has a very shady background and endless corruption scandals. But they still, the U.S. embassy and the activists, they constantly want him to be. They want him at least.
Why?
To be,
I mean,
well, he's just friends with them, and he's right. You know, because they
need
some allies.
But he must be reliable too, I mean, because it sounds like, from what I understand and from your description, that the people in these organizations, they have some power, and they serve as basically levers of as leverage that the U.S. and the EU that fund it, that they have to keep an eye on their, you know, their vassals in Benkova and in the Rada. Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like, this was described by different Ukrainian media that is opposed to these structures. I mean, now it's Zelensky media is saying this. They describe them as colonial instruments. And now you can have Zelensky media. I was listening to pro-Zelensky bloggers yesterday, and they were all calling them the you know, colonial instruments of the West and so on and so on. And but yeah, I mean, that is what they are, and that they gather. They have like wide-ranging powers to gather information on you know, politically immune politicians, because, you know, politicians, they have sort of a level of political immunity generally, but the NABU bypasses that. It also doesn't really have constitutional. It's not really provided for in the constitution, because it's this weird organ that sort of exists outside of the you know, law enforcement structures put forth in the constitution, and it's come in conflict with just about every part of the Ukrainian political establishment, even like the pro-Western types. You know, I mean, one funny, interesting thing is that they also went after Arsen Novakov, the interior minister under Poroshenko, who set up the Azov Battalion. Yes. And so he really dislikes them, and his Avakov's people, they call NABU Sorosites, which is like the sort of derogatory term for these people.
Is that where the term Sorosites kind of starts? Because the labeling the kind of the whole NGO class Sorosites, or
I mean, as I mean, I don't know the actual etymology of the term. It's just a very popular term in Ukraine. I mean, I kind of assume that it I have a feeling it kind of came out of Ukraine. I'm not sure. It might have it might have been around since the 90s.
It's very funny, but, because it's both kind of viciously ironic, but also true, you know, and it's really, you know, and has tinges of anti-Semitic conspiracism around it too. So it works.
But it's just entertaining to say in Russian and Ukrainian, it's like Sorosyonok or Sorosyata, which is like, you know, a piglet. But Soros is little piglets. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, yeah, these people, I mean, I think it's interesting how to call them, because, I mean, they do have this very unique vibe to them, right? Like, you know, they call themselves activists or whatever, civil society, but that's such a neutral term that doesn't really actually give any specificity to what they are. Because, you know, I mean, there's a million different types of civil society and, you know, I don't know, Brazil, I'm sure, is very different to, you know, these guys, these anti-corruption organs. Because there's this whole ecosystem of like these different small anti-corruption organs that are always, you know, lobbying to, you know, support the NABU or criticize the NABU for not being fully independent. And I mean, I guess this is the thing. The thing with NABU is, I mean, it's not actually effective. It has imprisoned like one person that wasn't even that important. And because, I mean, the thing is, it has the ability to arrest people, but it doesn't really have the ability to actually like fully convict them, or it does, but it isn't able to actually use that. Anyway, it's just one of these classic, just sort of really weird, unclear, vague things.
Right.
And it's able to arrest people, and then you'll have obviously, I mean, there's the suspicion that it sort of goes after more people that are opposed to the Western agenda in Ukraine rather than those who support it. Right. I mean, the main purpose with this thing is not even just to go after certain politicians, but also just to keep the whole political class in Ukraine kind of, you know, on the hook and always sort of, you know, worried about not too confident and not right. willing to centralize and become autonomous and take its own decisions because it's always worried about, you know, whether the Nabu will go after it and so on.
Right. And the Nabu representing the power of Washington and Brussels
yeah.
will always keep them a little nervous about it because they all want to park their money in the yeah. West or whatever and have visas to the West. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and then I guess the thing with Nabu and all these different structures is under Zelensky, there was always this, I mean, before the war, there was endless, you know, they weren't appointing the people in the Nabu in time and Zelensky's government was sort of like dragging out the process. This really annoyed the IMF and civil society people and so on. And then in wartime, there have been lots of different events where basically the Nabu would investigate some kind of... there was one case that I wrote about last year where the Nabu was investigating this guy, Yuri Golyuk, who's in Zelensky's inner circle, this corrupt figure, who often met with Zelensky involved in construction corruption, related to the fortification, actually, some
right.
stuff, as I recall. Anyway, but he managed to quickly escape any arrest. And then it came out that there was actually a lot of top detectives and top, figures in the Nabu that were cooperating with the government and that were leaking him the information of the investigation throughout. And then you had like different, you know, activists angry about this and so on. But what I mean is that the Nabu has always... it's never really been, you know, independent in the,
right.
in the sense. I mean, it's always been beholden to different, you know, corrupt interests and so on.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was listening to an interview with this Ukrainian businessman, Denis Delinsky, with this pro-Zelensky blogger, Yuri Ramanyanka, and Delinsky was saying how he's happy that Nabu is being cut down because he was very angry about his business getting raided by Poroshenko back in 2017 and Nabu like didn't care and so on. Basically mm-hmm. saying that Nabu was in cahoots with Poroshenko, which is, you know,
right.
fairly.
Right, because not going after government, they also have the power yeah. to not say anything about government
yeah.
corruption, right? And then the mm-hmm. West, their sponsors would be like, well, Nabu's not complaining, so it's okay mm-hmm. what he's doing, right? So it works
yeah.
both ways, yeah.
Yeah.
And that puts them in a position of a lot of power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was always this, the Nabu was never really that independent, but it's still, you know, there still were people in there that were opposed to Zelensky and gathering different investigations on him. And basically the past couple of months, I mean, I guess this kind of the overall tendency that's been taking place since the start of the year is obviously Trump's in power. Mm-hmm. Lots of Zelensky's opponents are, there are lots of political figures in Ukraine very unhappy with Zelensky, particularly Petro Poroshenko, ex-president, who's
right.
Close to these Sarasite networks and so on, has lots of media assets under his control. And around, it was what, like the end of last year or so, Zelensky concocted this new charge against Poroshenko, that Poroshenko received suitcases of cash from Moscow. And there were these photographs that they shared of like Poroshenko's security guards going to the airport and getting these black
wow.
suitcases and so on. And I mean, Zelensky already has this whole court case against Poroshenko since before the war. For
right.
this other,
as basically a traitor, right? They, by the way, just in
yeah.
case we didn't make this clear, Poroshenko was the first Maidan president from 2014 to 2019. And then he got pasted in the elections by Zelensky when Zelensky ran as a peace candidate in 2019.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. And Poroshenko yeah. portrays himself as like
yeah.
this nationalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, he's actually has pretty bad relations with the nationalists, especially in his presidency. But now he's trying to, and with the Sarasites, but now he's right. like, they're united against Zelensky.
Right.
So basically Poroshenko is very worried about getting put in prison or whatever. You know, I mean, you had Zelensky put his main patron in prison, the oligarch Igor Kolomoisky in
right.
2023. And so apparently, I mean, this different media is saying that Poroshenko is genuinely very worried about Zelensky. So he's been really stepping up his criticism of Zelensky, giving lots of interviews about how Zelensky's a dictator and so on. This is the past 7 months since the beginning of the year.
Right.
And you also have the Klitschko, the mayor of yes. Kiev. I mean, he's been calling Zelensky a dictator yes. in Western media since like 2023.
Yes.
And he's also had a very long conflict with Zelensky since before the war. But this year with Trump, these opposition figures to Zelensky really hoped, it seems, that Trump would get rid of Zelensky, maybe. And when there was the argument with Trump, between Zelensky and Trump, Poroshenko was making statements about how, you know, this right. shows how Zelensky is immature and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Not and fit I think to really, lead, you know?
Yeah, yeah. 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 And we need a mature man yeah. like myself that can, you know, really deal with these Americans. But so they hoped that Trump would get rid of Zelensky. And then you had Poroshenko's media constantly criticizing Zelensky. And then you had the sort of Sorosite media, like this Ukrainska Pravda, Ukraine's kind of biggest liberal publications owned by Tomasz Fiala, who's this Czech businessman, who's a business partner of Soros. You know, and it's not a conspiratorial thing. I mean, it's just like longstanding. Well,
and Ukrainska Pravda also backed by USAID, right? And the US embassy yeah. and stuff. In the pre-Trump days, but yeah.
Yeah, it's unclear. I think they claim the USAID is over now. But Zelensky has been threatening to sanction Fiala as well because of Ukrainska Pravda's kind of constant negative press of Zelensky and so on. So that's all been taking place over the past 7 months. And then you had the past, I guess, 2 months, you had especially prominent stories about there was the corruption of this figure close to Zelensky, well, Minister of Unity, Chernyshov, who was meant to... They made this weird... Chernyshov is some old friend of Zelensky who goes to Zelensky's parties, birthday parties and so on. But... From show business or something like that. But Chernyshov was given this weird... They made this new ministry for him last year called the Ministry of Unity. And the purpose of the Ministry of Unity was to return Ukrainians back from abroad.
Right.
Which is, this has always been an obsession of Zelensky since his election. He always talked about how there are too many Ukrainians abroad. They need to come back and so on and so on. But
right, because the emigration wave started really the big one started with Maidan, right? And then the period between Maidan and the war. I mean, of course, it started even before then, since like 91, 92. But there was another big wave after Maidan. A lot of them went to, you know, whatever, Russia and Poland, and then of course with the invasion, a massive emigration wave.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so obviously very bad for demographics, you know, tax collection and so on. Yeah. So
mobilization.
Mobilization. Yeah. I mean, lots of them are women as well, but it's just for, you know, future of the country, taxes. But so Chernyshov was meant to return them, whatever that means. But then there was this very sort of ironic scandal a few weeks ago, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, where Chernyshov was on a business trip in Europe and he didn't return in time because there was this NABU investigation about his corruption. And there was obviously a lot of jokes about that in the Ukrainian media space and very absurd situation. But then he ended up
a lot of jokes playing on the minister for returning Ukrainians won't return, right?
So. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But then he did return and he like announced that I'm back and I'm not scared. And then NABU sort of abandoned their they stopped really pushing on him. I think he's now lost the ministry because there was a cabinet reshuffle and anyway.
Right.
But I think they might have even removed the ministry.
Right.
Anyways, there was that. And then also recently there have been talk of NABU going after Mindich, who's a really important figure in Zelensky's very, very close circle, like one of the most powerful people in the country. And then also, and then Zelensky basically, before Zelensky closed down the NABU as well, not closed down, but this new law about the NABU, Zelensky was also doing this big kind of offensive against lots of these well-known Sorosite activists. Like Shabunin, who was mobilized to the army after the past few years where he claimed to be fighting in the army, but he actually wasn't and was receiving salaries for that and also a car and all this sort of thing, a classic sort of story.
And he's a big NABU and SAPA, basically a big anti-corruption crusader, right?
And he's not in Nabu and Sapo. Okay. He's in ANTAC, this smaller anti-corruption action center. Yes. He's people don't even really like him that much, even in the anti-corruption crowd. He's a very loose cannon, sort of like fight like physically with people and so on. But they're saying, you know, even though not everyone likes him, we still have to support him because this is an attack on all of us.
Right.
And Zelensky also did the same thing with this other really pretty vile journalist, Bogdan Butkevich, in a Poroshenko-owned, Poroshenko-partnered media company, Cenzor Net, very nationalist, liberal publication. He's also been mobilized. His wife tried to claim that he's actually a secret agent who's secretly serving. But that was not true. But it's just funny because Butkevich, he was always talking on the media about how anyone who evades the draft is a total loser and they need to be shot or whatever. He's very, very aggressive. But now he's crying about getting sent.
Isn't that the case with a lot of these Sorosites that they're constantly saying, if you're avoiding the draft, you know, you're destroying the country. You need to be, you're an enemy, you're a traitor. But not all of them got themselves exempted or fake mobilized, basically.
Yeah.
So they're not liked at all. Yeah.
It's a widespread phenomenon. Yeah. And I mean, so Zelensky was doing that. And then after these different cases, which also got lots of anger from this crowd in Ukraine, and then Zelensky put this new law that requires the Nabu to have oversight from the General Prosecutor's Office in Ukraine, which is controlled by Zelensky. And people got really angry. And the parliament approved the law very quickly. Parliament was very happy. Zelensky's, you know, parliamentary fraction, 7 of the people, it was also supported by the remnants of the like the pro-Russian party, although it's kind of not exactly pro-Russian.
Yeah, I love how they always have to point that out, the pro-Russian party. Like, what's the pro-Russian party doing there if you call them pro-Russian? What they are, as you pointed out a lot in events in Ukraine, I mean, they were obviously aligned with them, but they're the perfect party. Like, it's perfect that they have that hanging over their heads because you can make them vote for whatever you want or they go to jail. So the only way to prove they're not pro-Russian is to do whatever Zelensky tells them to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they're also pretty happy to vote for this bill.
Right.
In particular, they've never liked Nabu very much. But also other politicians like from Yulia Tymoshenko's party and different old, you know, classic Ukrainian politicians voted for it. And then there were these protests. We can talk about them a little bit. But I mean, the latest news is that Zelensky has, well, a new legislation bill has been introduced to the parliament that would sort of return to some extent Nabu's independence. But it hasn't actually been voted on yet in the parliament. And the thing is that right after they announced the Nabu bill, right after the bill was voted for, the one that removed the independence, the parliament announced it would take a holiday for a month. It wouldn't return for a month.
Okay, perfect.
So the speaker of the parliament hasn't said when they would return to talk about this new bill. They asked him about it. He didn't really respond. So it kind of looks like Zelensky just trying to deflect the criticism. And even if the bill is passed, the Nabu is still kind of under him. And I think like the main thing he's trying to do is to sort of neutralize this opposition of like Poroshenko, these different remaining Democrat Party NGOs. I should also mention the Nabu played like the first trigger role in the Russiagate. They were the ones that publicized or like leaked or created or whatever the Manafort, you know, black box documents, whatever.
Right.
So that's also relevant through like agents that have this whole weird history of with the CIA and with the, you know, secret services and so on. Very, very funny story. Another reason why I don't think Trump will care.
Right. That's what I was going to ask. So Nabu and these anti-corruption activists played a big role when everybody was sure that Trump was just some kind of aberration and he'd be gone. This was a great way to ingratiate yourself with the American deep state and power centers by handing them over what they wanted for Russiagate and manufacturing it if they had to. I would imagine that Trump doesn't give a shit about what happens to Nabu. But at the same time, Trump is also not a fan of Zelensky for the exact same reason, because Zelensky just, you know, he got sucked into Russiagate, but he also then became kind of an accomplice to the impeachment, right? So, but in any event, I think, yeah, without Biden in power, Zelensky would feel more empowered, or it would feel safer to really take down Nabu. Didn't you say that, I think it was you, that Shabunin, this anti-corruption guy that everyone thinks is an asshole who pretended to be mobilized but then got really mobilized. Didn't you say there was a new like verb in Ukrainian, like shabunizatsiya or something to describe it? Or was that you or no?
I mean, yeah, there's this journalist, Volodymyr Boyko, who's really obsessed with the Shabunin case, because Shabunin was actually had a fictitious position in Boyko's military unit, because Boyko was actually fighting in the war for the past 3 years. Anyway, and Boyko did endless investigations and was actually one of the people. He's given testimony in court about on the Shabunin case, and he's one of the he wrote the protocol to get Shabunin, you know, investigated and so on. But yeah, he has this term Shabunin. So he says the latest news in Shabunin. This is he always has these posts. Funny guy.
So the public doesn't like these people. These people who are protesting, I guess, or what they're protesting on behalf of, is the interest of what you know. You first wrote this up earlier in the war. Is really the new nobility class. I mean, that NGO class, until Trump kneecapped them, they were already quite powerful before the invasion. But after the invasion of 2022, when like the oligarchs really lost enormous amounts of power, and the Sorosites, the NGO class, became one of the real sources of deep power. Right, as a kind of a class, along with, let's say, like the military intelligence community. So it's interesting seeing, granted, it's nothing, as you wrote about, it's nothing like the actual Maidan protests in terms of size and scale, when they got hundreds of thousands of people at it, you know, at some points. But still, they were able to get some people out. And were they all basically from that class, or is it that the protests started and then other people who've already been, because there is a lot of discontent in Ukraine for all kinds of reasons about how poorly the war is being conducted, about how poorly, you know, Zelensky is leading the country. So did it wind up attracting like a larger mix of people who are just generally discontented, or who was it? Do you know?
The photos I've seen, it's definitely just the urban students who also have, you know, military exemption. It's also, I mean, you're not really going to see that many men going out in the center of the capital right now, because they'll get mobilized. So, I mean, the people that are protesting, it's like women, but I mean, really these like middle class urban people, right? Like not necessarily, they don't necessarily all work for NGOs,
right?
But they're in that space of that class, you know, milieu, and maybe some of their friends work in NGOs, but in general, like these people, the greatest value in their worldview is, you know, European integration and the EU and so on, and they believe that this is threatening Ukraine's chances of this, which they still believe exist. So they are protesting about this. But I mean, yeah, the Nabu is not, no one cares about the Nabu in broader society. There was Paul's friend, Volodymyr Ishenko's, talking about these that show that even the secret, the security services of Ukraine, the SBU, are more popular than the Nabu. This is
It's the ex-KGB, basically, is more popular than the Nabu. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really well known for its corruption and its extortion and criminality, the SBU. And the SBU were the ones that actually arrested the Nabu. Because before Zelensky put this law through, SBU arrested a bunch of NABU top figures, accusing them of being Russian spies and so on, yes, in the usual, yes, usual manner. But what I mean is that, yeah, people don't really care about the NABU. It'd be, you know, kind of interesting if this became a broader protest about, you know, mobilization, but it really isn't. You know, I mean, the mm-hmm. people there, they have these, you know, they have posters saying like, you know, my father is not fighting in the war for this, right, and so on. There was one that went really viral that lots of like, because lots of right-wing nationalist people in the army don't actually like these protests. They think they're mm-hmm. a bunch of like LGBT liberal, right, you know, draft dodgers and stuff. And there was this one guy that sort of had a, I don't know, maybe he was gay, I'm not sure, but he looked not like a militant nationalist, mm-hmm. to put it that way. And he was holding up he was at the protest, and he had a poster saying like, my mother is not fighting in the war for this, which was, I'm not really sure if it was a joke or something, but like, right, anyway, they all shared this, all of the Azov guys. Because the Azov people have been like, they really don't like this protest, and they're happy the NABU is gone. They've always actually been very critical of what they call the Sorosites, and they were even, and that's actually coincidentally why in 2020, 2019, 2021, the Sorosite community, they began accusing Azov of being FSB Russian agents and so on, and saying that they're allying with the pro-Russian, wow, forces and so on. And then the Sorosite faction, group in Ukrainian society, they sort of created their own nationalist, pro-liberal figures to oppose, right, against Azov, like Stepienko and Gonov. Bit of a different story, but what I mean is that there's like a split within the kind of important contingent of Ukrainian society, of like the military nationalists, where you have like some of them that support these protests. These are like the more liberal aligned ones. There's like the National Guard section of Azov under this commander Prokopenko. These are the guys that were in Mariupol. They, right, support the protests. They're like much more liberal aligned, and they're actually violently now opposed to the other Azov guys under Beletsky, the more classic Azov guys in the army. And the classic Azov guys in the army, they don't like it. They're making posts about how they dislike it. But there was one interesting post.
I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we should, nationalist is kind of the, a nice way of putting it, but a lot of these guys are straight up neo-Nazis. Like Beletsky is just out and out neo-Nazi. And all the other guys at that level are at least a neo-Nazi adjacent with their tats and some, right? Mm. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was also just looking through like the reaction of some of these military telegrams about this. There's one, Muchnoy Jugend, which is
nice liberal name. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. He loves, he really likes like the Derlewanger brigade, whatever. He's always posting like Derlewanger. Like he has like all these emojis that he made, and like there's like Derlewanger. He's one of
what
the most.
What is it about the fucking Derlewanger? But like there's so many different nationalists and neo-Nazis, whatever you call them, nationalists here. I mean, you kind of have to call them that, who love the Derlewanger Brigade and love the symbolism and love to kind of slightly alter the crossed, German hand grenades, because that brigade were just psychos. They didn't achieve much, but they were just sadistic psychos, even by, you know, the worst SS standards. What is it about them?
Well, I'll have you know, Mark, that Muchnoy Jugend is a renowned authority in the military OSINT community. But he's like one of the most prolific kind of frontline, I don't know, posters on Telegram. Yeah. I sort of stop reading them that often because honestly, it's too detailed sometimes. I don't really care what's happening in like, you know, this tiny village or whatever. But he made a post about NABU, and he was basically angry that people are paying attention to NABU, but not the suffering of the soldiers. He was talking about all of the men that have been listed as missing in action, but that are actually dead, so the family doesn't get support. And, people that are, you know, in captivity on the Russian side, and no one is protesting about them. There was also a post by this other military, like neo-Nazi telegram called Mannerheim's Son. And he had this big post about Nabu where he seemed to sort of support them, but he says that he doesn't really care about Nabu, but he's just angry about the situation in general, saying that soldiers are no longer fighting for something, but despite something.
Right.
He's saying that when the war ends, we're all going to try and leave the country, and definitely the army. And he even has this line where he says that a soldier who's been sitting for 3 months in a muddy trench in a 1.5 by 1.5 meter dugout, sleeping on the corpses of his comrades and getting water delivered by drone is not part of anyone's agenda. And he says as well that he's certain that if soldiers start speaking openly about what they're dealing with, the very existence of the state may come under threat, which is interesting. And
that,
he says he doesn't care
sense.
About Nabu, but
I mean, it makes sense that, you know, that these guys are, they're going through hell. Their commanders suck and shake them down, and you have to buy your way out of, you know, getting certain death. And then there's finally a protest. So and even polls, even within Ukraine, are showing how much anger and discontent there is about the leadership of the country. They assume everybody's corrupt, that this is the, there was that one poll I saw where a larger plurality said the biggest problem facing Ukraine is the corrupt elites, more so than the Russian invaders.
Yeah.
So they're dealing with all that, and then finally there's a protest, and you have, you know, forced mobilization, all these things. What you just talked about, which is incredible too, all of the Ukrainians who are still reported missing, and they won't take back the dead that the Russians will try to give back to them, not because the Russians are good, they have their own reasons, because that means the Ukrainian state will have to pay the families. So they just keep reporting them missing in order to put off having to pay the families for the dead. So there's all that. And then what is the one protest about? It's between one faction of elites against another faction of elites about, you know, basically making sure that they could still get their visas to the EU, because that's what holding on to Nabu is all about. Right. So it must be so demoralizing to see that, A, that there are protests against the government, and that, B, it has nothing to do with them and what they're all going through. I wanted to ask you while we're on this, that I couldn't help but think of the infamous open letter by Ukrainian civil society published in 2019. And that I just remember being so shocked. I mean, it's hard to be shocked over and over, but shocked and outraged, and just kind of people, there was a, you know, small group of people who watched this stuff who weren't just completely, you know, in the tank for the whole Nabu Maidan thing. We're just so shocked that here this guy is elected. The Ukrainians are like trying to get control over their lives, and everything had gone downhill since the Maidan. Economically, the country was torn apart, there was war. So they vote this guy in to try to bring peace, to end it and try to get some decent, you know, normalcy back if possible. So all these civil society groups publish this open letter, which is a threat to the incoming president, Zelensky, who's voted in with nearly 75% of the electorate. And they say explicitly, here's our red lines that you cannot cross or we will might on you. I just circled a couple of them here. And they listed all these things that he can't do, based completely circumscribing what they can do. And this is all, again, this is signed by all these organizations, funded by USAID, funded by the NED, funded by the EU. So it's really them or their satraps talking. Among the red lines is holding a referendum on the format of negotiations to be used with the Russian Federation. So you can't hold a democratic referendum on it because the EU and US-funded groups say you can't. Conducting separate negotiations with without the participation of Ukraine's Western partners. Delaying, sabotaging, or rejecting the strategic course for EU and NATO membership. One of them here, which I had forgotten about this, on economic issues, initiating major redistribution of wealth in the interest of specific groups. So you're really fighting the oligarchy there, aren't you? And then under government functioning, the very last point in this letter is delaying or sabotaging anti-corruption reforms.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the last thing. And if the president crosses these red lines, and that's an exact phrase, then, you know, all these signatories say, we're going to organize another Maidan. And they crossed those lines, and it's, you know, and then you had a protest, and that was, it was at least real enough that Zelensky did have to at least make a show, a big show of backtracking, which is humiliating. I mean, all of this has undermined his rule no matter what. Like, he's taken a lot of criticism from a lot of major, well-connected media outlets that had always supported him. He, there was criticism from, you know, political figures in Europe. There are, like, people have seen in Ukraine a cleavage open up. So have the Russians, for that matter. So it really did have consequences. Would you agree?
No, I absolutely would. And I mean, it was a major factor between Zelensky becoming much more anti-Russian and nationalistic, because these figures were always protesting his attempts to negotiate with Russia.
Right.
There was a period when Zelensky and his right-hand man, Yermak, were negotiating closely with Russia in 2020. And then you had Bellingcat put out this whole story that Yermak and Zelensky were sabotaging Ukrainian intelligence covert operations against Russia.
Right.
And then these Poroshenko, you know, and liberal activists began essentially pushing for a military coup through these resigned intelligence agents, because of the Zelensky's treason and so on.
Bellingcat's propaganda help. Let's not forget that. Yeah, it's just incredible. Huh?
Yeah, they were always talking about how, look, well, Bellingcat has shown it. Bellingcat, I mean, I wrote about an article about it. It was a whole silly mess. But they definitely do exert pressure. What I did want to say is, I mean, the interesting kind of speculation that some people have, obviously not going to, but the interesting speculation is that perhaps this is Zelensky's sort of 5D chess, you know, where he's getting rid of the liberal nationalist opposition in time for a agreement with Russia, mediated by Trump, which is obviously very exciting, but probably unlikely. But I mean, right now there's been some kind of negotiations with Russia, new negotiations. And I looked at the results of them yesterday. It actually seemed somewhat not bad. They were sort of agreeing about something. Although,
really?
I mean, it's just this... Well, I mean, there was something about agreeing on the need for some kind of joint plan of action or something like this. But I mean, you know, the thing is with these negotiations, I don't know, it's hard to take them that seriously, in all honesty. I mean, because it's been going on for so long, and it's always just some kind of vague, you know, statements by both sides that are actually kind of saying different things and so on and so on. But in any case, it is an interesting idea. And the thing with Trump as well is where it really seems like Trump is fairly on good terms with Zelensky now. I mean, since Zelensky signed the mineral deal back in May, or when was it? I think it was May.
Yeah.
It gave the U.S. all this sort of special access to Ukraine's resources. And also last week.
Is that real? I mean, is there really something to that? Because I don't know. I've heard also, you know, people saying that, yeah, it looks good on paper, gives Trump a win. It probably did endear him more to Zelensky, because what makes Trump happiest is when people supplicate to him, especially people that he's humiliated.
Yeah.
Like Romney, you know, just when he makes, when he, like Marco Rubio, you know, little hands Marco, whatever. He likes that. But I don't know how much substance there is to it.
Well, the thing is that there's actually there's a published part of the mineral deal, but there's also an unpublished part of the mineral deal that Zelensky, I mean, like, this is the way that it was presented in the Ukrainian parliament, where it's like, we're voting on the open part, but there's also this whole secret part, but we can't show you that. So, I mean,
I see.
It's actually that I'm sure there's plenty of, I mean, if some part of it has to be secret.
Yes.
It must,
so there's some real
mean
to
something.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's more just in terms, I mean, all of this talk of lithium, I think that's often hype. I mean, the mineral, there's not really that many. There aren't really that many precious minerals in Ukraine, particularly at least under control of Kyiv. But but there are plenty of factories and different economic assets. Last week, there was this story in the Financial Times about how Zelensky forced some Ukrainian businessmen to give up control of this grain terminal in Odessa, one of the biggest in the country, and give it to these American, Swedish businessmen. So, I mean, Trump has stopped talking about, because remember when he first came into power, he was saying we need to remove Zelensky and new elections. And he's totally stopped that when the minerals deal went through. And
that's true.
I think it's interesting what you mentioned, because there definitely is a strong anti-Zelensky campaign now. I mean, it's always existed. The West always disliked Zelensky. Mm-hmm. When he was elected, they saw him as too conciliatory towards Russia and so on, too much of a populist, not nationalist enough. And even in the war, there have been different publications about how, especially Zelensky's inner circle, Yermak and Tatarov, that are the most hated by the liberal activists and so on, and also the West. Yermak was seen as a Yermak, he grew up as well. Where was it? Zelensky grew up in Mongolia a little bit, and they often hint that he was, some kind of his father, because his father had a higher position in close to the military intelligence type of stuff as an engineer. But then Yermak's father was the FSB, the KGB, really important KGB agent in Afghanistan. Anyway, and Yermak has this whole. They think he's a Russian spy and so on.
Right,
they're convinced he's a Russian spy.
I'm sorry, Yermak. Just for people who may not know, Yermak is the head of the presidential administration. He's his right hand man, basically.
Exactly,
Zelensky's right hand.
There's this new material that came out, I think, in the Financial Times just a few hours ago, which was saying that apparently Zelensky and Yermak, they sleep in the same. In the same room or the same bed, and they also walk around with guns. This is what they're claiming. This is the classic thing. Whenever they start getting criticized, they start talking about how there was this really funny thing when the Sarasite journalists started asking uncomfortable questions to Zelensky at one of his very few press conferences. This was earlier this year about Yermak. Like, why is Yermak still in power? And Zelensky got very angry, as he often does at press conferences, which is why he doesn't hold them. Mm-hmm. And he began this amazing story about how you can't criticize Yermak, because Yermak, in the first days of the war, Yermak was killing Chechens. and
wow.
Yermak is this, this gray bureaucrat who's a TV producer and so on. So they have some kind of very strange. Apparently, Yermak is very, very emotionally attuned to Zelensky, like extremely emotionally attuned, and he really
Zelensky's
knows.
Zelensky's again, he was an actor. He's an entertainer with an entertainer's ego, and so Yermak was on the producer side. So and very good at it. It seems like so he really knows, as you said, he's so attuned to this entertainer's ego.
Yeah, I mean, Yermak also worked for the Yanukovych. Lots of Zelensky's inner circle, they're former Yanukovych government people. I mean, Tatarov was in the Yanukovych's interior ministry that was, the pro-Russian president until the Maidan. And
Poroshenko was in Yanukovych's cabinet too, right, at one point.
A long, long time ago, yeah, that's right. But, but then Yermak worked for this Yanukovych parliamentarian for a long time and so on. Mm. Anyway, so I mean... But what I wanted to say is that you mentioned, I think it's worth what you said, which is that lots of these publications that are more anti-Zelensky are these British publications, and then the American publications seem to be not aggressive about it. And I think that, I mean, obviously Europe and the UK, they're definitely much more invested in this whole liberal, these different liberal civil society things they've been funding forever. But Trump, he likes the sort of man-to-man conversation, bilateral things. He doesn't care about this, international, liberal system and so
order,
on. Exactly. And so it's an interesting thing. But I really, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I really don't feel like people are predicting Zelensky's, removal and imminent removal. But
yeah.
it really seems unlikely to me. I don't know. It's been predicted so many times already.
Yes.
I was talking with a friend of mine, a Ukrainian friend who escaped the country a year or so ago. He's a funny guy. And it's interesting as well because our mutual friend is an Azov now. And he's we used to like party with him. And now he's this Azov guy. But this friend that I talked to, he's very, very, I don't know, black-pilled or whatever about Ukraine, about everything. But he was just saying, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe they'll replace Zelensky with Zaluzhny or Budanov, and then they'll stop mobilizing women, and you know,
right?
But I mean, it's like even if they remove Zelensky, I don't know, it seems like it would just the same, more of the same. And I mean, it's an interesting idea. Maybe they're sort of, you know, worried that Zelensky might sign something with Russia, so they'll remove him this way. But I don't know, it seems unlikely. I feel like they're gonna have some protests. Zelensky will make some symbolic gesture, and then they'll forget about it in 2 weeks' time. That's
right.
Maybe I'll be wrong, but that's how I feel.
You wrote about Cy Hirsch's piece, but Hirsch's sources in intelligence have been saying for a couple of years now that they want to get rid of Zelensky because he doesn't have what it takes to cut a bad peace deal, which is inevitable for Ukraine, and that Zaluzhny is the only guy that has kind of the respect of the military people to cut a bad peace deal. Mm. I mean, whether that's true or not, I'm sure it's true that there are people in intelligence who, a faction at least, who do believe that and are leaking that to Hirsch. But I agree with you. Like, you know, this all assumes that they have that kind of, you know, ability to decide who's ruling Ukraine. And Ukraine is not like, you know, Russia's right next door and has deep, deep ties and deeply penetrated Ukraine very deeply and still couldn't control Ukraine. So it doesn't seem like it's, you know, unless they're going to do a DM thing and just whack them, it doesn't seem like it's such an easy thing to do and to control.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it's, I mean, like with, I agree that, you know, it does make sense, this logic of Zaluzhny being able to sign a peace agreement. And even Budanov, the spy guy,
yes,
he there was this kind of this big kind of scandal sort of thing at the start of the year when he said, well, it was a liberal publication, Ukrainska Pravda, that publicized this, but Budanov said that we need to end the war. Otherwise, by the end of the year, our state will collapse.
Right.
And this got Zelensky's people angry about Budanov and so on. But it seemed like, and I was writing back then about this possibility that Budanov and some other people are sort of allying to try to connect with Trump and end the war, bypassing Zelensky. But, you know, obviously it didn't happen. But yeah, I don't know. Right now it's definitely hard to say. It seems like Trump is more positive towards Ukraine than before. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, maybe we could talk a bit about
let's talk about the front lines. Yes, let's talk about the front lines because they've been crumbling at a kind of a noticeably faster rate than before. And that's what attrition is supposed to do. It's supposed to, I mean, the concept of attrition is you hollow out your opponent, especially when you're much larger and have a lot more depth like Russia does. You haul them out and then the lines start to crumble. But I mean, in the last few weeks, we've just seen, like, particularly around Pokrovsk, the Russians not only are starting to encircle from the northeast, but they also got some basically, you know, recon and sabotage units that made it, as I read anyway, that like zoomed straight into the center of Pokrovsk.
Mm.
And they're holding some parts of kind of, what would that be? Southeast Pokrovsk, I guess, but they're not. That's just smaller units there, and then they're also, you know, breaking apart more in larger chunks areas leading up towards Kostyantynivka and also like going north, like Kupiansk area, Vovchansk. What are you reading? What are sort of the trends you're reading from the Ukrainians?
Yeah, so I mean, throughout the year, this year has been a lot more Russian territorial advances. There was, I think, this year so far, it's been already 2,300 square kilometers, and all of last year was 3,500. So,
wow.
And this is, you know, this is a large territory. It's twice the size of Luxembourg, as Bild reported on it. But and then you have, I mean, the Ukrainian strategy is that they're always saying that Russia will run out of infantry and of armor and so on, that their offensive will eventually collapse. But they've been saying this for a very, very long time now. Yep. And it doesn't do that. And I guess the key factor in all of this is the amount of reserves and the mobilization capacities of either side.
Right.
And it's interesting, recently, you know, you had this statement by Taras Chmut, who's a well-known Ukrainian military volunteer, also actually this liberal kind of anti-Zelensky guy, but still a very well-known figure, who stated in an interview, this was week before last week, that Ukraine is losing more men each month than it recruits. Mm. And not only wounded or death, but also desertion and so on. Whereas in comparison, Russia is taking on more people each month than it loses.
Right.
Which is quite notable. And I mean, there was also, I mean, I... There was this journalist, Vladimir Boyko, who's this military journalist. He gathers lots of statistics from the state court register about desertion. And he found that it was just this year, there's been 150,000 cases of desertion, which ends up being something like 15 to 20,000 cases a month. Although, I mean, let me just, I have the statistic somewhere or other, but anyway, it doesn't.
Yeah, I saw I saw that in one of your newsletters. Yeah, it's like, he said basically we have no infantry anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, he says that it's all depending. He says that the army is vastly inflated, the real number, and the real number is actually 30 to 50,000 people mainly at the front lines who are mainly drone operators and so on.
Right.
And you have this whole, and the army is just not really able to punish desertion. The government keeps on increasing the deadlines for when you can return back to a unit, but there's no real punishment for this. I mean, different units will have their own punishment where they'll beat the soldier or the different torture
crucify
methods
him.
And so on.
Yeah, as you
crucify
pointed
him,
out.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that was a big story. Yeah. Yeah. But the military prosecutor, the military justice system was removed in 2019. And since then, there's no special military courts, and there's no way to actually punish this whole...
So that's why there's not some larger means of doing that. I see. Why was that, why was that military courts, why, or the whole justice system, military side, why was that gutted?
Well, this was actually, I mean, Volodymyr Boyko is really obsessed with this topic. He constantly brings it up as the reason behind this. And also some Azov people as well are very angry about this. Because, you know, the U.S. has its military justice system.
Yes.
It's a fairly normal case, a fairly normal situation generally. But yeah, it was removed in 2019. It was actually at the initiative of one of the most well-known anti-corruption activists, Reba Shapka, who's constantly U.S. embassy demanding he remain as the prosecutor general back when he had that post and so on. But why exactly it was removed, who knows, probably some kind of strange, you know, intrigues and power play.
Right,
whatever.
So the theory was it was corrupt, but the reality was some kind of factional infighting, and is that right?
Yeah, I'm not super clued in on the actual, I tried to figure it out what actually happened, but not super clued into that. But Boyko blames these anti-corruption people and so on. But in any case, it doesn't exist. And so, yeah, the number is this 16 to 20,000 desertion cases registered monthly, but also probably higher because there's lots of underreporting.
Right.
Commanders look bad if they report lots of desertions. There's also some recent changes in the law that made it harder to report them. But whatever, so there's that. And then and then apart from that, then you have the other interesting trend of this year, mm-hmm. which is the Russian technological development on the drone sphere. lots of Ukrainian different military analysts, even the BBC, have been talking about this Russian superiority in drone technologies now. Before, they always used to say that, you know, Ukraine has this technological edge. It's the Silicon Valley or whatever. And Russia, their drones are made of, you know, shit and sticks or whatever.
That was part of the whole, the framing. It was like the first year and a half of the war that they're orcs. The Russians are orcs. They're apes. They walk into, you know, gunfire. They steal washing machines because where they come from, they don't even have toilets. And right, it was that whole, I don't know what purpose that served. It really blinded people to the danger for a while. I mean, I remember seeing people like, pro-Ukraine, pro-military accounts like Tatargami saying, I think it was that one, saying like, we've got to stop this because we're not facing the reality that Russia's very good at this. Mm. And it's not helping us pretending that they're not. But that was a big thing for the first. And they loved convincing themselves of that. It was not smart. Yeah, never underestimate your enemy.
And Russia's this year, Russia was the first to adopt these fiber optic drones that have been really crucial, because they avoid the radio electronic warfare that was able to stop the other previous type of drones that did not use, that used like wireless connection.
Right.
And then also Russia has just been experimenting a lot with these new different drone technologies, using different, you know, AI vision detection, though it's unclear how actually widespread that is. But I mean, they're definitely experimenting with it. It could also be beneficial because it could allow these drones to be wireless, but also not be interfered with, because they would just use the AI to detect their target and would not have a wireless internet connection that could be interfered with. But there's that. And then beyond that, it's just the increasing distance capabilities of Russian drones. Now that they're able to fly, you know, 20, 30, even 40, 50 kilometers and really interfere with the Ukrainian logistics. And the past, obviously this is in the other direction as well, but the Ukrainians do seem to be saying that it's the Russians that are developing much more quickly in this respect. And the whole big obsession nowadays is with logistics. And you have Ukrainian military telegrams constantly putting out new articles about the importance of logistics, the worsening of logistics. And they often recall that the retreat from the Kursk area in March of this year in Russia, it all happened because experienced Russian drone teams cut off the roads using drones, and they put the logistics under pressure. And then the Ukrainians had no choice but to retreat. And now the similar thing is happening with Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka and so on. And they're constantly drawing these parallels, these Ukrainian drone teams. And so this is this major. It's also interesting. There's an interesting debate going on as to whether this could just lead to some sort of general, I guess, stalemate, because you have these kill zones on either side that are 10 to 15 kilometers and growing, where it's just impossible to use any vehicles at all. This is also a funny, and maybe this will just lead to a stalemate, but at the moment it's definitely not, because the front line is moving in one direction with the Russians.
And accelerating, as far as I've been seeing, at least lately. There have been days where they've taken like 30 square kilometers of territory to the northeast of Pokrovsk. I mean, and those have been pretty static, or like, you know, it would take like a week to take like a square kilometer, and they seem to be crumbling. And you also wrote about how, like, and again, it's probably both sides, so this is really also going to come down to who's producing and who's commanding it better, but that that the Russians are expanding the how deep they can kind of control, you know, behind the lines, not just 10 to 15 kilometers, but now like 30 kilometers. And by the end of the year, the Ukrainians are predicting it could be 50 kilometers or more. So there's just like, it looks like there's no way you can move at all. And yet the Russians are still they're moving faster. So it's kind of baffling. And I guess that means that I suppose points to, among other things, how few people the Ukrainians really have. I mean, that's what I'm reading about this from Ukrainians, that in Pokrovsk, they've had just a massive manpower problem. And it's probably the case in other fronts as well.
Yeah. And there's like from the 23rd, it's like 2 days ago, this big Ukrainian military telegram, this guy from the Aidar battalion, Stanislav Bunyatov, he was talking about how the Russians, they're getting in between our positions in the Pokrovsk area. That's what he was saying, which is, you know, obviously so that there are lots of just spaces in between where there are not enough people. Right. And according to the head of the Azov, Biletsky, he said last month that we have like one person for every kilometer. That's what he was saying. And I mean, obviously, it's always
it's an
trying
exaggeration,
to hype up his,
but yeah.
I mean, yeah, and he's saying that other units have two or three per kilometer, but we have one, you know, so we're like super soldiers and so on.
Right.
But still, I mean, there are really serious manpower issues, and it really depends on drones. I mean, Bunyatov saying that how 90% of our work is with drones. And the other big problem is that there are some units that are much more effective and have, you know, powerful drone capacities and so on. But then there are lots of others. Particularly these newly formed units that lots of military commentators and, you know, military commanders, they really hate these newly formed units that Zelensky has created. They blame Zelensky for it. I'm Zelensky's man in the army, the head of the army, Sirsky, for making these new units, but they have no experienced commanders. And they're just filled with civilians that have been given guns, mobilized people, but they have no real drone capacity and just no experience. And then what often happens is these units will be taken, they're like attached to other units. It's this practice in the Ukrainian army of attaching a unit to another unit. And this is very strongly criticized because it often just involves the attached unit being just used for its personnel and getting worn down in battle. This phenomenon was actually blamed a few days ago by this other military analyst, officer, alias Alex, for losses, for falling back in the Kupiansk area.
That's up north.
Yeah, in the Kharkov area, basically, where he says that there was this territorial defense unit, which is this basically civilian, essentially mobilized unit, or at one point volunteers, and they've just been used up by their commander and dying, but not in a very sort of unwise manner.
Right.
So yeah, there's the way it's being described for a long time, where it's you have some experienced units, and whenever there's a new fire on the front line, meaning like a new Russian advance or a new Russians attack a new part of the front line, these experienced units have to abandon the fighting where they're actually fighting already at the front lines, and they're forced to go and mop up this mess elsewhere because the units there are unprepared.
Right.
And so obviously this is a very dangerous situation where they're constantly putting pressure all across the front line, advancing, you know, and they advance in one area, like in Sumy recently, and then it sort of slows down and they, you know, encounter, you know, the Ukrainians are able to build up some fortifications, but then they sort of advance in another area, but they also maintain the pressure in the Sumy area. There are still, the Russians are not advancing so quickly in the Sumy area, but the military correspondents are talking about how there's still heavy losses on the Ukrainian side as well, because the Russians are keeping up the pressure with the drones and artillery and so on. So it's this kind of tactic of, you know, death by a thousand cuts, is how it's often described, where putting pressure on the manpower and the more experienced units are just constantly exhausted because they have no rotations. And in contrast, the Russians do have rotations of their infantry reserves. It's an interesting description of one military telegram talking about how, I think in the Donetsk fighting area, in like the Pokrovsk area and nearby as well, to the south, how the Russian, they have constant rotations of the infantry reserves, unlike the Ukrainians.
It's huge. Yeah.
But in contrast, the drone teams remain the same, and the drone teams on the Russian side are constantly teaching the newer teams their experience and so on. And it seems like the Russians have some very powerful drone teams that are, there's this one like Rubicon and another one, I forgot the other one, but there's some well-known Russian drone teams that are quite feared by the Ukrainians.
Right.
And that are also sort of spreading their knowledge.
Right. Naturally, the Ukrainians' famous drone team is called Nachigal, after a Nazi battalion that murdered Jews in 1941, because they can't help themselves, I guess, right? I mean,
it's just, that's right. Yeah, Nachigal. Yeah.
Nachigal, right. Yeah, you also had so many interesting things here. One of them was one of these accounts, Officer, I think, where he talks about how the Russians, what do they call them? It's because, you know, it's the slur for gay, you know, faggot. But yeah. In Russian, it's in Ukrainian, pederast. Is that what it is? Pediki or pederasty or
pidri?
Pidri. Okay. Anyway, he says that the Russians have this new thing where they build launch tunnels for drones that are hundreds of meters
really cool.
long.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So it's like, and then the drone sort of drives through this long, many football field lengths tunnel, and then emerges out somewhere much closer to the lines, and that protects the drone operators as well, right? And also hides where the drones are coming from.
Yeah, that was quite an interesting account that I that was from July 16, where they're camouflaging these tunnels, and then they emerge in the open space. Yeah, there's lots of interesting other innovations right now. They also have these waiting ambush drones, which are often like fiber optic drones, and they'll sit, like literally
right.
sit in a field, and sometimes they have weapons and they'll wait for a vehicle to appear, and then they'll attack the vehicle, fly up and attack it.
Right.
One recent account from a few days ago said that they had a photograph, a Ukrainian account. They have solar panels. So this was actually a reconnaissance drone. So it doesn't have a military, it doesn't have like a explosive component,
right.
but it's just watching, and it will just sit, and it has a solar panel, so it keeps it with energy.
Yes.
And it's filming and so on. And then it can also
it can stay airborne much longer that way. Yeah.
Well, it's also just sitting. It's not actually flying.
Oh,
so
I see.
It's sitting in a field.
I see.
And
filming.
It's filming and it's watching the cars drive by. And then this can also call in a drone strike.
Right.
But I mean, one thing that I also kind of forgot to mention with the logistics situation, which is that since it's now impossible to use vehicles in the frontline area. And
right.
you have like most of the losses are not even fighting at the front line, but it's you're driving in a vehicle and your vehicle gets hit by a drone
right.
on the way to the front line. But
right.
but this means this is also why, you know, because you have this whole thing of Ukrainian military telegrams making fun of the Russians for, you know, walking in the fields.
Right.
But then they also admit that we're also walking in the fields. We have no option. We can't use cars anymore. And then you had this narrative of the Russians are running out of tanks because
right.
they don't use tanks anymore. But the reason why is just because you can't use tanks on the front lines. It's a very large target for drones, and it gets destroyed. And they still sometimes use tanks, very like, you know, fortified and so on. But it's very impractical. There's an interesting story actually about a few days ago about apparently they're using these North Korean tanks.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's
crazy.
They'll hide in a forested area, and then they'll shoot at Ukrainian positions from the tank from a distance of 5 to 6 kilometers. But it's in a hidden camouflage spot, and even it's quite difficult to destroy it anyway.
They're like compact tanks or something, right? The way you just you're
yeah, like smaller.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's this whole situation. I mean, and in order to advance, it does require infantry, where you need to have individuals moving forward, taking new positions. This is obviously something that the Ukrainian side lacks.
Right.
And, you know, the Russian side does have them, humans and also motorcycles. Moving forward in this way, and then also obviously lots of air support for them. Generally, before they move forward, they sort of destroy the Ukrainian trench positions with, you know, artillery
right.
and guided aerial bombs and drones, and then the individuals move forward, trying to take these positions.
Yeah, I saw that one OSINT account who follows more like aerial strikes said that just in like the last 8 days, Russia had launched 450 airstrikes. I don't know how many of them were FABs on Ukrainian positions in Pokrovsk. And the idea is Pokrovsk has basically been just thoroughly hollowed out, but by an army that's already pretty thoroughly hollowed out for all the reasons you're describing. But I noticed also like a lot of pro-Ukraine accounts, and I think even in some of yours here too, but they're always saying the problem is, well, the commanders and really the whole command structure needs reforming. I've been hearing this for like since the counteroffensive failed. You know, they want, it's not enough just to blame the Soviet mentality. That doesn't really mean anything. I think, you know, they know it. It's a way of just kind of getting rid of somebody maybe, but they keep thinking there's some reform that needs to be done, some magical reform, and it's never done as far as I can tell. Have you been able to follow much of this? Like, what does it mean to change, to reform the command structure? And like, does this just mean that our commanders are suck and are corrupt, or is it magical thinking, or is there something to it, or do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty detailed post about this on my Substack a couple weeks ago, because there's this the whole reform, it's this core reform, moving from the existing system that Ukraine had. It's actually a bit of a convoluted thing. Ukraine used in the Soviet army, there were corps, but then in the post-Soviet period, as I understand, in the 90s or the 2000s, Ukraine moved away from the corps. And the idea of a corps, and it's often described as, you know, Ukraine's NATO reforms, like in NATO style with NATO's corps. I mean, the USSR also had corps, but anyway.
Right.
But the idea is, I mean, it is like a logical idea, which is that the idea is for the existing system is you have these temporary structures which have control over at a larger operational level over different military units, over the brigades, where they go and what they do and so on.
Right.
And this faces a lot of criticism because these structures that control the brigades, these structures are temporary. The people in there come and go and they don't have much connection with the actual units. And they also control too large of a section of the front line, and they're not able to actually be involved and feel responsibility for the units, for the soldiers, and they're often accused of this is leading to, you know, excessive losses, and they're just wasting people and so on. But this reform was announced moving to the corps system, which would give closer, essentially, coordination between the units, and the person in charge of the corps would be more involved with the brigades themselves and would be a permanent position, not a temporary position. This was announced at the start of the year, and it's been going on ever since then. But it's quite unclear how much has actually proceeded. There's not actually much information about how many corps have been created. Supposedly 20, but many of these corps, it's unclear who's actually heading them. It's unclear if they've actually been set up. And then the other problem is that there's still many of the problematic practices that were criticized. They still continue under the corps system. For instance, the attaching of other units to your unit. This is still continuing, and you have many military commentators saying that this is a massive problem that needs to end and should not be continuing under the new system. Then it's also, I mean, with this new corps system, I mean, it's the same commanders.
Exactly.
But obviously the idea is that they're choosing like the military elite, and you have Azov, you know, at the front of the corps system, and they're sort of proclaiming that they're leading the reform, and you have them talking about how if you gave us the whole army, it would take us $2 billion to transform it onto our level, and that's a massive saving, and so on and so on. But it's definitely uneven, the quality of the units, and the results so far of the core reform seem to be fairly lackluster. I mean, there is, you know, a lot of it is more, it seems to be more the key kind of question seems to be, to a major extent at least, individuals, where you have, like, for instance, you have this figure, Drapati, who's this high-level mm-hmm. commander who the Azov guys and the liberals, they really like him. Now, lots of frontline commanders seem to like him, and he's been conflicting with the head of the army. He seems to be more effective. But in terms of the actual reform, yeah, it's definitely there's not clear results to the reform so far.
Right.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to have to get going soon, so we'll try and wrap this up. But I'm curious if you have a sense of what the actual losses are on each side. I know this is like a really tough question, but I was surprised to see Hirsch's intelligence people, anyway, intelligence sources tell him that they thought that Russia had suffered 2 million casualties. And that seemed to me like a lot larger than reality, but we don't know, you know, or at least I don't know. I feel like the most accurate, because it is at least grounded, estimate of Russian losses was the one, I think it was Medusa or Mediazona, and with Baby C, yeah. It was like 110,000, 120,000 Russians, and probably roughly the same Ukrainians dead, and then, you know, and then however many wounded. But where do you come down on that?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's always hard to say, because, I mean, you have, if you read lots of Russian military telegrams, they'll be like incredibly pessimistic, and they'll be talking about how, you know, like, they seem more pessimistic than the BBC about Russian military losses, some of them. And lots of it is some kind of strange political things, I think, in Russian, different conflicts between different power groups. You know, because this is, you know, you had Prigozhin was the classic example of this, where he was just talking about how everything's totally terrible and it's because Shoigu's in power, and, you know, and so on. But obviously it does, I think, you know, there are serious losses on both sides. But I definitely, I mean, Hirsch's number of 2 million is very strange, because, you know, you have, I mean, Zelensky actually claims casualties of like 700,000. That was his last, in December 2024. He said to, I think it was the BBC, that there were 200,000 Russian deaths and 550,000 wounded. And that was at the end of last year. And right currently, the Ukrainian army, it claims 1 million casualties. And it's just, it would be very strange, because there's many people think this is a major exaggeration. This includes deaths, it's not just deaths, it includes the wounded. So I don't know why. I think it's a kind of a thing where you have these intelligence sources in Washington that tell Trump that there's, you know, like 2 million people dead or whatever it is, and they tell Hirsch this, and, you know, I mean, I don't know what Hirsch's stake in all of this is anyway, but I think there's definitely this, you know, political information war aspect. But in terms of the real casualties, yeah, I mean, I think it must be somewhere over 100,000 for both.
Right. I mean, even 200,000, it's, you know, it's a pretty bloody and huge front. So it is. It does seem possible as well.
Like, yeah, I mean, it should also be kept in mind that, you know, the fighting, it's not, you know, massive waves of humans. It's actually very small groups of infantry, like two or three, and a lot of drone cover. And then the other thing to keep in mind as well, first thing is there's not actually that many humans often fighting. But the other thing to keep in mind is that is this often, you know, it seems logical that Russia would have much larger losses since it is on the offensive.
Right.
But the thing is that Ukraine is also constantly on the offensive. They're constantly launching new little mini offensives to try and take back X village or Y village, which is very criticized by many military, you know, Azov commanders and so on, and other, you know, critics of Zelensky, who say that this is leading to massive losses and these are, you know, useless suicidal missions. But the commanders feel pressured under general staff to say that, you know, we've taken back this little spot of land or whatever. So The Ukrainians are also on the offensive, which leads to losses. So
yeah, that's true.
It's not a straightforward answer where it's like, you know, if this side is on the offensive, then the Russians are on the offensive, they must be taking, you know, X times more losses than the Ukrainians. It's not actually as simple as that. I think one of the interesting, there are some different attempts at calculating Ukrainian losses using similar methods to the BBC Media Zona thing with the funeral notices and so on.
Right.
And also came up to something around like 150 or 200,000. I remember there's an Azov military telegram that I really enjoy following. It's Tales of the Fourth Reich,
yes.
Which is now Tales of the Fourth Empire, rebranded.
I see.
But
depoliticized.
That's right. I mean, he still loves Hitler. He's still open about that. But yeah. But he calculated, because he kind of wants the war to end. He thinks that Ukraine, it's destroying the army too much, and Ukraine's, he hates Zelensky, and it's being used for corrupt purposes and so on. He's a kind of old-fashioned white nationalist, thinks and so on. But he calculated based on the number of funeral notices in his local newspaper, in his home area of the Chernihiv region. And he just looked at kind of how many funeral notices every day in the newspapers, and extrapolating across the whole country. And he sort of estimated 120,000 deaths. And that was at the start of this year or the end of last year. Yeah, I guess somewhere around the 200,000 is what,
right.
That's what it seems in terms of deaths, and then definitely a few hundred thousand injuries in addition to that.
Yeah, I mean, usually depending on the war and the military and how good the medical evacuation technologies are, injuries would be, the number of injured when you know the dead would be anywhere from like 4 to 10. Like I know a lot of Americans survive pretty awful injuries that hadn't been survived, you know, in previous wars. So the number of injured was a lot more than the number of dead in Iraq, for example. But people had all kinds of just horrific head injuries and stuff like that. Well, I think on that depressing note, anyway, I think we can end this episode. Thank you again so much, Peter Karatayev, and I cannot recommend highly enough, if anybody is interested in Ukraine or just in like in the raw how societies work and how empire works on societies. There's just so much great material in Peter's Substack, Events in Ukraine. We'll put links to it. But you will have very few or no illusions about this war after a few of them. You will be depressed. You may want to kill yourself, but you won't have illusions about this war. So anyway, thank you again so much, Peter Karatayev, for talking to us at Radio Warner. And look out there.
Thanks so much for having me on. Great to see you, Mark.
Great to talk to you. All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Brandon, too. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All the best, guys. Have a good one.